Hello all and welcome to The Cutting Edge. I'm Dr. Eric Moore, Deputy to the Commanding General here at DEFCON. This episode will feature cybersecurity and networks. We're happy to welcome Mr. Bob Kimball, Chief Scientist at DEFCON, Command, Control, Communications, Computers, Cyber Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Center, also known as C5ISR. Mr. Kimball, thank you for joining us today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. Now, Bob, could you start by introducing yourself and your role at the DEFCON C5ISR Center?
Sure. So, hello, everyone. I'm Bob Kimball. I'm the ST for cybersecurity for the Army. And in that role, I keep an eye out on what the future looks like in terms of cyber and what are the types of research that the Army needs to invest in order to survive and thrive in the battlefields of 2030 and 2040 in the cyber domain.
So, Bob, I remember Pat O'Neill was the director of the center, and as we went through some rebranding at DEFCON from RDECOM to DEFCON at AFC, and I don't know if he came up with the term, but he came to one of our board of directors meetings and mentioned the fact that he wanted to change the name to C5ISR. And at the time, several of us were scratching our heads. We knew C2, we knew C3, but C5ISR. So for those out here who may not know, could you break down what C5ISR means and how it empowers soldiers in modern warfare?
Sure. So C5ISR, the five C's are command and control, communications, computers, and cyber. And the ISR, of course, is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So if you think about it, what C5ISR is the eyes, ears, and brains of soldiers on the battlefield. And so it's the enabling technologies that allow commanders to communicate with subordinate units, control subordinate units, and gather situational awareness about what the battle was going on in the battlefield.
So let's kind of tease that apart a bit, because when you started your career, we didn't think of it in terms of C5ISR and all the capabilities we have today. And so in your role as a senior scientist, how have you seen that evolve over time?
Yeah, well, so, of course, I started a long time ago.
Did we all?
So, you know, command and control has been around since armies have been around.
Right.
And the, you know, if you think about the classic, the fog of war, which is that what the commander wanted to get done and what the troops actually did often were not aligned very well.
Yes.
And so as communication technologies improved, warfighters understood that the ability to communicate between commanders and subordinate units dramatically improved the effectiveness of the units. And then from as a technology perspective, you know, as radios got more and more effective and useful and pervasive on the battlefield, the computer did the same thing.
I got it.
And so now you could do a lot more things in terms of processing your information, packaging information so that it made more sense to more people, communicating more effectively. And the computer is an awesome tool for doing that. And then, of course, once you introduce computers, you introduce people that try to disrupt them, and that's where the cyber piece comes from.
Tracking. Actually, I have a daughter who's a cybersecurity expert, so I love that space. But when I think about computing and the evolution of computing, and think quantum, optical, or neuromorphic systems, you know, we think about these transforming technology. From your perspective, how might these advancements reshape cybersecurity against emerging threats? Because you just highlighted some of those threats. Anytime you have computers, there are folks who want to hack those systems.
Yeah, so with all of those computing platforms that you talked about, they all represent transformative leaps in computing potential. Both in terms of computing, raw computing power, as well as just the kinds of problems that you can look at with the computers. And so it opens the opportunity to ask questions or get answers to questions that you never could before, which is a has a lot of, you know, intense power on the battlefield, both from trying to figure out what the enemy's intention is, figuring out where their forces are actually deployed, and even if they're trying to obscure them and all those kind of things. But and then in the cyber arena, it will start to allow us to, again, get answers to questions of a size and scale that we never could get answers to before. One of the things, you know, you always hear about, if somebody launches a cyber attack and you want to be able to do something back, yes, right, to go back and disrupt their ability to continue to either harass or disrupt you. Well, attribution is an extraordinarily difficult problem. Yes. And it's because of the way the internet's built in the past for the internet are so Byzantine. Now, when you get to the point where you've got neuromorphic or quantum computing, you can start answering questions that say, you know, what were the BGP boundaries of the internet through East Asia as this attack came through, which then could point me to, oh, I do know where this threat actually came from, and I do now have the opportunity to do some either kinetic or non-kinetic response to actions in cyberspace. So the advances in computing allow you much larger scale, yes, and more intense depth of the questions you can answer. The other thing that it's going to do, which is going to make a huge difference, is if you think about the evolution of AI over the last 15, 20 years, the capabilities that we got in terms of the AI being useful parallels almost identically with the advances in compute power that have occurred over the last 20 years. And so when things like quantum computing comes in, that's
it's a game changer.
That's not a small jump. It's a huge jump in capability. And so I expect we'll see the same kind of huge jump in capabilities in AI systems and our ability to employ those to both defend networks as well as, either from an offensive perspective with what we can do or what our adversaries will do against us.
So will there also be accompanying evolutions, do you think, as quantum computing and some of these other approaches become more commonplace, specifically in terms of areas like deep learning, machine learning, our ability to handle complex algorithms? Do you think that will?
Yeah, absolutely will. And let me let me be remiss here. The big one, the first one that's going to come and punch us right in the nose, and it's going to happen fairly soon, is cryptography.
Ah.
So the crypto systems that we've relied on for decades now rely on a very simple fact that in terms of factoring prime numbers, it's very easy for computers to multiply prime numbers, even very large ones. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for them to factor.
Ah.
And that's the essence of what the current crypto algorithms rely on. Well, quantum computers break that. So they are able to factor prime numbers fairly effectively. Now, there are other methods, other mathematics that people have used, and as NSA has been doing research on this for a number of years, and NIST has a set of algorithms that they believe are very robust against quantum computing. So we're in the kind of the part of the world where the quantum dawn is here. I mean, that the sky is getting gray.
Yes.
And so we need to take action to get after that as soon as possible. So we'll start to see post-quantum cryptography coming online very soon. And now to answer the direct question, yes, I believe that the ability to do much denser neural networks, mm-hmm, with many more hidden layers and the ability to do more inference off of these things and will give us a lot of advantages or much stronger AI performance than what we see now.
So kind of pulling that string just a little bit from a mathematics perspective, will the math that we use actually change as we go into some of these more complex systems or?
So from a crypto perspective, yes. So the current leading post-quantum cryptography algorithms are more based on geometry than they are on integer calculus, the way the current ones are. So, the math is still the math.
Yeah.
They'll just use different approaches.
That's very informative. Thanks very much for that. So, looking ahead, you mentioned some of the trends. What potential breakthroughs excite you in this area, and how can the Army stay ahead in that space?
Well, stay ahead, that's a loaded question, right? Because I don't know that we are. So AI is huge, right? The ability, if you just think of just on APG, because that's where we're sitting right now, the amount of data that we generate every single minute.
Yes.
Out of all the people, out of all the tenants that are on this base, doing their work, doing, their mission, is all cyber data. And in that data, if there are any threats to the missions on this base, it's in that data somewhere.
Yes.
And right now, we can't see it, or we can see very little of it. Mm-hmm. And so what will come with these advances in computing and advancing in AI techniques is our ability to broaden our aperture so we can look at everything and start to see those things hidden in the data that we already have.
I got it.
And in addition to that, we'll also have the opportunity to look at a lot more data, stuff that right now we don't even collect because we don't have the processing power to be able to address it. We'll stop not collecting that. Now, the storage problem isn't going away, right? It's still very expensive. But where that gets very interesting is if you have compute power that's strong enough that you can look at that data once and then not have to store it all. Look at it, make that determination. This is an important piece of data, or it's not an important piece of data. And I can discard this data because it was just doing expense reports or doing my five bullets. Didn't matter. This is critical. This could tell me that something is going on. I need to save this because it could give me a clue to something else. And being able to make those decisions very fast on the fly can address the storage problem. And help us get ahead of what our adversaries are doing.
So, you went to a place which I think is very important to another question I want to ask you in terms of bandwidth and energy challenges, because if we're collecting everything, and now we've got also, we have a capability now to start to discern what's, important of all this, what used to be considered noise, but what about the bandwidth and energy challenges we might see?
Well, they're huge, and they're real. Bandwidth in terrestrial communications is almost infinite now. It's not true tactically.
Okay.
But that's going away too. Mm-hmm. As we start to get all these LEO satellite constellations, both the Starlink, which is very effective now over in Ukraine, but all the other competitors are in that market now. You're going to get to the place very fast, I think, where the days of tactical networks looking completely different than enterprise networks is going to go away. Because you're not going to lose all your comms all the time the way you do now.
Right.
You're going to have some comms, maybe different comms. It'll be very dynamic communications because stuff will go up, stuff will go down. You'll lose your ability to use this box versus that box. But you'll have something almost all the time. And so being able to link all that stuff together gives you capabilities that... it's going to change the way we look at defending the networks.
So as we think about defending the networks and our academic versus industry partners, because it truly seems like it's going to require a strong partnership, industry's moving out. How do we keep pace with some of the change that we're going to see?
So where we've been, especially from an S&T perspective, for a very long time, is, I'm speaking cyber now, specifically. In the enterprise world, where bandwidth isn't a real big concern.
Right.
Now, it certainly, that's been a something that's been true over the last 15 years, wasn't true before that. Now that bandwidth is much less of a constraint, and people have gone in a very large way into cloud-based services and cloud-based applications, the protections for those kind of systems, industry's been far ahead of anyone else for a while.
Yes.
And from an S&T's perspective, from a C5IR's perspective, we encourage that, and we adapt our S&T strategy to the fact that industry is very, very good in that space. And if the Army wants to generate capabilities, then the best way to do that in the enterprise space is to work with industry. In the tactical, and we've done many, many experiments, and we just finished one at MOD-X this fall, where we looked at some zero trust capabilities that were very effective, very well-known companies, very respected companies, and we put them out in the field, and they didn't work so good, just because in the DIL environment, when bandwidth and energy are major considerations,
yes,
these enterprise solutions tend not to work so good. But we're starting to see, it's not true today, but if you look over the horizon, we're looking to a future where we've got much more communications capability and much more diverse communications capabilities that allow us to operate regardless of what's going on in either terrain or adversary actions or whatever, that will allow us to adjust the way and some of those adjustments may look like some of the industry solutions may end up starting to work better and better in a tactical environment, which means that the S&T work needs to make a pivot to an area where the industry isn't really involved.
Now that sounds like a real sound approach. Do you see more opportunities to serve in an integration role, perhaps, in helping as industry moves forward?
So that's a great question. So personally, I very much do see that. That isn't something that we've traditionally taken on as part of our mission set. Now, one of the things as an ST that's a big part of my job is I spend a lot of time with the Navy and a lot of time with the Air Force.
Mm.
So I spent a lot of time with the other service laboratories, with DARPA, with NSA, and so on. So some of those laboratories are further on that journey than the Army is, and they've pivoted towards that integration mission as a big part of blending the best part of what industry can bring to the table.
Yes.
With the mission specific applications and technologies that only a military lab can produce, because there just isn't enough market for an industry to do it on their own.
I agree 100%. It's not enough market, not enough money, not enough talent. So combining that and collaborating more effectively is key.
And the one part that's so important is the fact that the scientists and engineers that work in these elements are part of the Army family. And so they get the chance to interact with the soldiers. They get the chance to see what the units see. They get to hear the stories. That is very tough for a vendor to get that access.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you understand, not that there's scientists and engineers in foxholes, but if you understand what the guy in the foxhole is feeling and wishes he had, it helps drive your work to provide to that person what they need, and you can't get that unless you're part of the family.
And we have had a number of initiatives to put scientists in the, well, I hate to say it this way, but scientists in the dirt, right? And at experimentation and training events, so that we could get an understanding of what soldiers in the field are experiencing and what the challenges are with some of the technologies
we're proposing. We support that a lot. But we also started a program, and we've had a couple divisions in. The third ID comes to mind because they were the last one, Well, we bring their innovation units into our labs and basically do a reality check with them. Here's what we're doing. Here's what we're thinking. Here's how we think you're going to use this. And sometimes the soldiers will say, "Whoa, yes, that's exactly what I want." Other times it's more lukewarm. But that's great. That's the feedback we need, right? So the most important tests of our work as scientists and engineers is its ability to transition and become useful. And so getting that operator feedback into the loop is a key part of making sure that we can do that.
I love that. You know, the more I'm here in my DTCG role, the more I see that throughout our formation, we are truly a formation of uniques, but there's some consistent practices that we all have. When I was at the Kim BioCenter, we had a program called the Saberni Warrior Integration Program. I know most of the centers have something like that that you just described, and it's crucial, and it is also a unique role that we can play as DEFCON scientists and engineers.
Right.
So you talked a bit about artificial intelligence. And as artificial intelligence and machine learning continue to expand rapidly, what strategies do you see as most effective for closing skill and staffing gaps in the cyber field, especially to meet the Army's growing demand for expertise in C5ISR technologies?
Well, from a staffing perspective, training perspective, one of the big hurdles I see is right now there's still this, if you're writing with ChatGPT, you're cheating. And we need to change that conversation to say, if you're not writing with ChatGPT, you're wasting the taxpayers' dollars because you can do it faster and better with ChatGPT than you could do on your own. And so part of that is that attitude shift, that they're tools. They're nothing more than tools. Now, you hear about them replacing people all the time, and I'm not a big fan of that, as I think there were a long way from these tools being good enough to replace a person. Whether businesses will do that or not is another issue, but I just don't think that's effective. But in terms of how we do our daily work,
yes,
these tools are force multipliers on the individual level. And so it's something we should encourage as part of people's daily work items is, did you use ChatGPT for this? Did you employ all the tools that are available to you? And then there's the from a more of a management perspective, but it's also from a technology perspective. Before we always had to narrow the questions we asked.
Yes.
Because there was a limit to the human capability to address them, and looking at cyber data is a perfect example of that. There's literally petabytes of this data that's generated, and a human cannot look at it. It just cannot. And so we narrow the scope to say, okay, if it's not a high or medium critical alert, you can let the rest of that stuff go. Well, when you have the AI tools and you have the ability to widen your scope and look at everything, then the task should now be, why didn't you look at everything? Why didn't you use the AI tools? Why didn't you catch that series of low-level incidents that actually turned out to be an adversary incursion into our system?
I love it. You're scratching my itch because folks that know me and you and I had a conversation with the STs down right after AUSA in Alexandria where we talked about generative AI. And I had just gone to this course at Vanderbilt for senior leaders on generative AI. And of course, I'm a big believer. And there are some Army systems, Camo GPT, the Air Force has NipperGPT.mil. I love them both. Sometimes I like to pit them against each other. And I get very interesting, but generally very spot on kind of critiques and looks. I would just say, though, that as you think about that space and getting kind of user trust, unencumbering our workforce from doing mundane tasks and leveraging some of these technologies, what do you think we can do to get people more comfortable in those spaces?
It's repetition. Mm. It's access. It's being comfortable with the fact that you're using these all the time.
Just trying it and starting to use it.
And what you said before there was a very, very important point. Trying these things against each other.
Yes.
Playing with them. They're tools, right? Sometimes a ratchet is the right tool.
That's right.
Sometimes a power hammer is, right?
That's true.
So depending on the job you're doing, one tool may work better than another, and the only way you know is by experience. And so to get to the root of your problem, it is repetition. It is familiarity with the tools. And I'll tell you a quick little story. We had a project in C5ISR that was going on for the last few years. Had to do with automating the cyber defense process, right? Mm-hmm. So the one problem that the team always had was they could never predict what the AI would do, which is scary, right? So if you're going to allow the AI to actually fix the cyber incident, if you can't predict what it'll actually do, that's a very difficult thing to deal with.
Yes.
And so the project had some headwinds because they originally were hoping to, drive to full automation. And from a research perspective, that they were solving the right problem. But when the team pivoted from full automation to COA generation and put a human in that loop where the machine now came up with the two or three best options of things to do and allowed a human to pick it, people's comfort level with that technology increased dramatically. And it was just that, and I think eventually if you see this thing make the right choice a billion times, you're going to say, well, why do I need to push that button? I just let the computer do it. But you need to go through the billion times.
Yes.
You can't just start with, I'll just let the machine do it.
That's true. And that's a whole other conversation, which sometimes becomes generational, different generations in the workforce, different levels of comfort.
Well, there's definitely different perspectives, for sure.
And so we're not advocating for letting the generative AI system write your term paper, but definitely helping you in terms of core outcomes and perhaps some mundane emails, definitely. Now, I wanted to ask you one other question along this network infrastructure.
So I didn't want to leave that too soon, right?
Okay.
We as an organization have to generate trust in these things as well.
That's true.
Camo GPT was trained on Army doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask it a doctrinal, because I played with it, if you ask it a doctrinal question, it'll give you a pretty good answer. We want to push these tools into the workforce. We've got to take a very hard look at what are the things we want to allow people to do to use these tools, and where do we lose trust in the tools and are going to force people not to use the tools.
Now, I do want to move on to this Army's network infrastructure. While I got you here, because I don't get many, I see you at the airport and stuff, but I don't get many opportunities to sit down with you, Bob. So why do you believe streamlining the Army's network infrastructure into fewer, more integrated systems is a priority? And how might this enhance operational efficiency for soldiers in the field?
So from my perspective, the overwhelming advantage is what it's going to allow is the Army to pivot 100% over to zero trust environment. In terms of cybersecurity and our ability to defend against cyber threats, zero trust is the best way that we know of right now to protect our networks. Now, it's funny for me to say that because I spend most of my day every day thinking about what we're going to do after zero trust. but for now, zero trust is the right answer. When we talked a little bit before about the bandwidth and energy problem.
Yes.
And the new capabilities that are coming into the networks in the tactical. So the fact that we're looking very closely at free space optics and optical networks, the fact that we're looking at high power microwave, the fact that we've got all these LEO constellations that are starting to appear. Starlink is fairly mature, but other ones are going up now, either planned or some of them are actually in installation. That's going to change the communications infrastructure on Earth. And then to throw that into the mix, you've got the terrestrial side as well with 5G and 6G, and the incredible advancement in capabilities that come with those new communication protocols as well. And what the net of that is going to be that there won't be any place on Earth that you are not connected to the rest of the humans on Earth. And that will be true in, you know, the wilds of Antarctica, and it'll be true on the battlefield. And so once you come to the realization that communications is going that way, then from a networking perspective, it no longer makes any sense to try to keep, you know, all these special niche networks that are optimized to work in their specific environments, because the general network will now do just fine in all environments, and now you can start doing some real serious protection of those networks everywhere. Because when you had all these little niche networks, most of them had no protections at all. Or if they did have protections, they were protections that were very limited by the technology that was used to develop the network.
So some would argue, though, that fewer systems might mean less redundancy and more vulnerability. So
they're absolutely correct. And politics aside, but from a technology perspective, diversity does provide strength. But that's a two-edged sword, because diversity also breeds complexity. And so the more complex a system is, the harder it is to defend. So you do have both sides of the situation. If I do think there's going to be a fair amount of time before the actual kit, the gear that we use in the tactical formations will be the same as we use in the enterprise. And they'll merge. I mean, they're on a direction to merge now. But there'll be differences, and so that requires specific expertise to protect and operate and maintain those various different pieces of kit. As you standardize the equipment, you can now standardize the training, you can standardize the maintenance, you can standardize the cyber protections, and all that becomes much stronger. Now, that the fact you started with was if you're homogeneous and somebody gets in one place, well, then they're in every place, and that is not going to go away. And you have to balance that between I can do a better job of protecting a homogeneous network, but now the risk of failure is higher.
No, I'm tracking. So this has been very enlightening. So to Mr. Bob Kimball, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about the crucial capability that is our network. I normally see you, as we were saying earlier, when we're traveling to Huntsville or Austin, Texas, or other places, but I finally get to sit down with you. You're a national asset and definitely an Army asset. So I appreciate you for coming in to speak with us today.
Thank you.
And so, thanks everyone for listening, and be sure to check out the next episode of The Cutting Edge.